From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA TV producer Philip Alexiou. Our guest on this edition of the program is Stephen Wallace, founder and CEO of the Omonhini Cocoa Bean Company and author of Obruni and the Chocolate Factory, an unlikely story of globalization and Ghana's first gourmet chocolate bar. Full disclosure, I have known Stephen Wallace for over 25 years and have been a strong supporter of his efforts to establish a chocolate factory in Ghana whereby the nation could financially benefit from its prime natural resource, cocoa beans, instead of shipping them to London, Antwerp, or Lyon for the production of chocolate. What I did not fully know until I read the book were the motivating factors, as well as the incredible grit, determination, and passion Stephen mustered to bring this dream to fruition, the production of the world's first export-ready, single-origin chocolate bar. We'll talk with Stephen, a former tax lawyer from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who previously worked in his family's T-shirt business, about why he decided to take a leap of faith and pioneer the first gourmet chocolate company in West Africa. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Philip. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I'm delighted to welcome Philip to the show. But first, I want to congratulate you on the book, Stephen, and your success for establishing the first company to produce a single bean chocolate bar entirely crafted in Ghana for export. That's extraordinary.
Well, thank you. I'm an overnight success. It only took 28 years. That's how these things go.
Exactly. Well, I'm delighted that you're here, and I'm proud to have followed your success using what you say in the book as, you know, the country's comparative advantage, the cocoa bean, its premier crop. Instead of shipping cocoa to Europe or elsewhere to gain the value added, you thought about doing it, you know, in loco, in the country, so that the country could indeed benefit from the hard currency. So let me ask you, Stephen, you know, what prompted a nice Obruni, Kwesi Obruni, a white guy, as they say in Ghana, from Wisconsin, who happened to spend some time in Ghana as an exchange student, as you said in the book, to later return and start this risky business?
I think back on it, and had I not been an exchange student when I was 16 years old, I can't imagine ever starting this business. So I was lucky enough to win a scholarship on a program called AFS. I was sent to this remarkable family upcountry in the town of Sunyani, Ghana. So a wonderful shout out to anyone who's listening in Sunyani. And I lived with this family of Yao Brobi. He had, at the time, three wives and 21 children, and I took my place as the 22nd child, and had great affection for the country. And even though we had a coup that year and the program was shut down, I was like that wonderful book on a bookshelf that you keep returning to time and time again. And when I found myself having practiced tax law and then moving into a family business after that particular law firm was going through some struggles, and then the family business was going through some struggles, I found myself by circumstance having to rethink what I wanted to do with my life. So sometimes failure is the mother of invention. And in this case, I always wanted to find a way to go back to Ghana. And I found myself at a relatively young age of 29, almost out of work or soon to be out of work. And what was I going to do? And I asked myself a real simple question. Where does wonderful chocolate come from? And most people in the United States say Switzerland. And then I wondered, how many cocoa trees grow in Zurich? And the answer, of course, is not many. I'm told there's one cocoa tree at a botanical garden in Zurich, but the truth is none. All the cocoa is grown in tropical countries near the equator. And I always wondered why they were at the bottom of that value chain. And going back to even the classical economists like David Ricardo or Adam Smith, they would talk about comparative advantage of international trade. And what it meant is you do what you do best. And I couldn't figure out why Switzerland had this monopoly on making fine chocolate when they didn't grow the beans.
Well, that's another question I have for you. Why do you think someone didn't have this idea before? Why had it not occurred? What were the factors in your view?
I think there's probably two reasons. And it was one, both countries like Ghana, who are very comfortable, at least historically, just simply exporting beans. So they got very good at it. It was, frankly, easy to do. They had a wonderful cocoa growing tradition, and people were comfortable. There was an inertia there. And on the other side, in the countries in Europe and the United States that crafted fine chocolate, they made the machinery that made the chocolate. They knew what to do with processing the beans, but they didn't have the climates to grow the cocoa. In some ways, that technology and the educational advantages that had for so many years been enjoyed by Northern Europe or the United States were leveraged into that production advantage. So it was as if characters on both sides of the table were comfortable, one making the machinery and making the chocolate, the other growing the cocoa. And I don't think anyone really wanted to upset it. And I was a little bit of a, I say this with a smile on my face, it's sort of a disruptor. I didn't intend to turn things on its head, but it just was so curious to me. I kept scratching my head going, well, kind of should have this freshness advantage. Why don't we at least try it? Why had no one tried it? And I suppose if I really knew what I was doing, I wouldn't have. So I was happily naive. You didn't grow up in the business, knew nothing about it, and hadn't worked there. And in fact, one mentor of mine who was with a $1 billion chocolate processing company said, wonderful idea, Stephen. I would have fired you years ago. It's that crazy, but I'm happy to see you're trying. So there's something to be said for the amateur.
What I found, Stephen, interesting was, I mean, here you were a tax attorney, so you know something about how complicated it can be to open a business anywhere, even if it was in the United States. But then you saw this niche for chocolate. But at the same time, the way the country was structured, you had to go through all these bureaucracies. You wouldn't have to go through, say, in a free market system like the U.S. And so you had a tremendous challenge. What are you thinking when you're going into something like that? Did you think it would take a long time to go through all this and to try to get this product going?
Let's all go back. That's pre-cell phones, pre-mobile phones, pre-computers. Everything had to go through old thermofax correspondence. So it was old school. That doesn't even exist anymore.
And the political context in Ghana.
And at that time, when I started first in early 91, it was still under military dictatorship. So I was an unsuspecting witness to the birth of modern, constitutional, democratic Ghana. Because we went from dictatorship to now modern democracy that's changed political parties, I believe, 3 times, successfully and peacefully since that time. So I saw all of this was happening, all of this was percolating right at the moment I decided to start this.
And that's what I found interesting, because as I was reading the book, I found myself getting frustrated with you every step of the way. And what got me was you didn't know any better than to just keep going.
You do the first small investment, which was really a pittance. It was a small amount in comparison. And then you're in too deep. And all of a sudden you can't withdraw, and it becomes personal. And you want to succeed so badly, you keep persevering. And the fictions you tell yourself is that you're this close to success. You know, small number. We're only a week away or 2 weeks away. And I recall, I think it was, for those of you who remember Ross Perot, the old presidential candidate, a business person, and he had once said, the problem with most business people and entrepreneurs in particular is they quit 2 weeks early. Mm-hmm. They're only 2 weeks away from success, and it's when they get frustrated and decide to quit. And I didn't want to make that mistake. So little did I know it would take the better part of a quarter century to get from start to finish. So stubbornness is part of the ingredient mix in my chocolate bars.
Well, certainly, Stephen, you had this affinity for Ghana, and you're quite an entrepreneur. But why chocolate, other than the fact that, of course, cocoa is the premier product of Ghana? What did you know about chocolate? I mean, you've become quite a connoisseur. And what's so special, for example, about single bean chocolate bar?
Sure. Well, when I started this, chocolate was really the vehicle that got me there. I looked at what would bring me back to Ghana. There were 4 things. It had been the Gold Coast as a colony, so they had gold, they had diamonds, they had bauxite, which is a mineral that you extract to make aluminum, and they had cocoa, reputedly the finest cocoa in the world. Well, gold and diamonds were capital intensive and sort of cartels and very tight industries. Bauxite mining was a $1 billion enterprise, required great amounts of skill and technical talent and money that I couldn't begin to approach. So I was left with cocoa. And I grew up in a family of people who loved to cook. My mother, my grandmother, my Aunt Min all loved to cook. And I was comfortable in the kitchen. So I said, why don't we do something with cocoa? So it was more of a fact, cocoa became a vehicle that I had to then learn about the technical aspects of chocolate production. as opposed to me having great expertise in it. And I think the fact that I was, again, naive about it forced me to learn it and gave me the freedom to ask all the sort of silly questions or the dumb questions that one asks if you don't really know the business. And I began to ask things of, how come there's no single origin chocolate? And I looked at this as, back in 1991, any chocolate bar in the world had a blend of cocoa beans from all over the world. So there might be beans from Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana and Brazil and Vietnam and who knows where. And it was really trying to reconcile the flavor profile, which was rather generous, and a rather strict price profile. So you'd mix, if Brazilian beans were cheap that month, you'd maybe put more of them in as opposed to the very expensive Ghana beans. And I looked at this and said, it should be like Cuban cigars or French champagne or single malt Scotch whiskey, that a particular place had a particular palate attributes, and I wanted to accentuate those. And I said, well, if Ghana makes the finest cocoa in the world, according to the Financial Times of London, it trades at a premium on the world cocoa exchanges, why don't we do a chocolate that's 100% Ghana beans? And to heck with how much it costs. Let's just see what that would taste like, and then people who really cared about cocoa and fine chocolate would at least get a very pure tasting product. And whether you liked it or not after that would be subjective. But I was going to give people the opportunity to taste a chocolate bar made from the finest cocoa in the world, unadulterated.
Along the way, you had to rely on some people to help you navigate your way through this. In order to deal with the Ghana Cocoa Board, which owns all the cocoa assets, for example, and you had other people along the way, how did those relationships work? Because there were a couple of things. You needed to work with some people in Ghana to help you along, and at the same time, communication between you and Ghanaians, it becomes very problematic.
Well, it does. And as I said, for most entrepreneurs, I think this is a part of the process. In sort of U.S. fairy tales, there's an expression, you have to find your fairy princess. So you have to kiss a lot of frogs, because the tradition was you'd kiss a frog and they'd turn into a magical person who could grant your wishes. So at the beginning of my time in Ghana, I was kissing a lot of frogs. I was trying to find that Ghanaian business partner who saw the world as I did, that maybe was perhaps age contemporary, so had a life in front of them. They had no reputation to lose. They had no success to give up. So that's why the age part was somewhat appropriate and had a sensibility for what I was trying to do. So I met a lot of people, and one in particular became my very close business partner, a Ghanaian, and had a lot of help from some of the U.S. Embassy and USAID folks there who took a shine to this, who took a liking to this project. As far as language was concerned, I knew enough Chui, which was the Ghanaian language of really the largest ethnic group, that I was able to sort of ingratiate my way into some conversations and knew enough. And it's a wonderful language that's full of proverbs. So there would be business conversations where everything's conducted in English and there'd be an impasse. And someone would lean back, a Ghanaian, and say something in Chui that was a proverb. This is one of those situations where the crab can't cross the river unless the turtle has his back. And you'd sort of think about it, and someone would explain exactly what all that meant, but it would capture the dynamic of where we were. If you had a large company versus a small company, or someone who was responsible for lots of people, they were the head person in a village, and someone who was a young person like me that was an upstart. And so these Chui proverbs began to capture the whole context of what it was. So I think my sensibility, having grown up in Ghana when I was 16, came back as a young entrepreneur to help me be sensitive to what I was getting myself into.
Speaking of Twi, Stephen, tell us the significance of the word Omanhini.
So Omanhini is an honorific title, and it's the title given to the paramount king or chief, we might say in English, but it's really king. So in Ghana, there would be a village chief, and there would be a provincial one, but the paramount one, the top one, the name of that is Omanhini, and to this day, the Omanhini is the repository of moral and ethical authority in Ghana, and that's what we wanted to publicize.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Stephen Wallace, founder and CEO of the Omanhini Cocoa Bean Company and author of Obruni and the Chocolate Factory, an unlikely story of globalization and Ghana's first gourmet chocolate bar. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA TV producer Philip Alexio. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a big shout out to all of our loyal listeners and fans in the great nation of Ghana. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guest, Stephen Wallace, author of Obruni and the Chocolate Factory and CEO of the Omanhini Cocoa Bean Company. Well, Steve, let's talk about some of the cultural obstacles you encountered as you were creating this business, trying to establish the chocolate factory in Ghana.
One of the things that was sort of surprising to me, and I think a difference, and I'm painting with a broad brush here, and one was it became very clear to me that a lot of Americans, 20-year-old Americans, think they can run Google or Apple or Microsoft. They have boundless confidence and enthusiasm and almost a misplaced sense of their talents. By contrast, I found at that time, going back 25 years ago, many of the senior ministers in Ghana who had advanced degrees from some of the best universities in the world were very risk adverse. And it was that disconnect between the appetite for risk by many 20-year-olds, like myself from America, and this sort of innate sort of trepidation to attempt new things. If you work in a ministry like cocoa, which at the time was responsible for about 50% of all Ghana's foreign exchange revenue, so it really funded the country. If you're the head of the cocoa board, you're not a venture capitalist. Your job is to protect the commonwealth of the country and to maintain and grow sort of organically and incrementally the cocoa wealth. You're not in the business of taking large risks. And let's face it, most venture capitalists in the United States, they fail 7 times out of 10. They break even on 1 and maybe 2 hit big. So you can't be a minister and with the wealth of a country take those sorts of gambles where you lose 70% of the time. And it took me a while to appreciate that, the difference, the burdens that these ministers carried with the responsibility of the country, in a country that didn't have a lot of economic wealth, to take the type of risks that I was proposing. So I realized that was my role. I was the one that had to take the risks.
There was a point in time as you were trying to get this business up and going, you'd figured out the formula for the perfect way to make this chocolate. But there was a point in time where, if I'm not mistaken, that when you ran into Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, and he had finally mentioned your company, that seemed to turn out to be kind of a big deal for you.
You labor by yourself quite a bit, and that's one of the things about being an entrepreneur. It's quite lonely because you can't afford a lot of staff around you, so you make a lot of decisions based with imperfect information, and you begin to tell yourself stories. Are you making progress or not making progress? And you're usually enthusiastic, and you tell yourself the fiction that, yes, I am making progress. However, the rest of the world may not see it. And so when Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown came to Ghana and we were up against some issues that had to do with divestiture, his office and he personally took a real interest in our little company. And we were barely producing any chocolate at the time, just starting out. And he was very generous and took us as seriously as he took advocating for huge multinational billion-dollar companies. That meant the world to me. You know, I was told on his plane flight over that he was serving Omanhini chocolate to the VIPs on his plane and the CEOs of the big companies. I sort of tagged along separately because just all I could afford at the time. And so when he got up to give a speech, he started by saying, I'd like to mention 3 U.S. companies that are doing remarkable work here in Ghana. And I was very self-satisfied and I thought, here it comes. He's going to mention Omanhini. And he didn't. First one was a no. Second one was someone else. And the third one was yet someone else. And I was just chop-fallen. I was so sad. And then he says, but there's one that's doing better than everyone else that I really want to highlight, a small company, and it was Omanhini. And I was moved practically to tears. I mean, I met the world because we hadn't had much success till that time. To have someone of his talent and his stature and his intellect say we were doing good work, said, all right, I'm going to keep at this now for another year.
So, Stephen, how was it to break into the U.S. market, and who were you actually targeting? I assume, you know, more of a niche chocolate connoisseur or
Right. We were definitely an upscale chocolate. We were not a low-cost producer. And frankly, I looked at the market and said the world, or at least the United States, doesn't need another chocolate bar that was more of a pedestrian flavor and average priced. You either had to go super cheap, which we couldn't do, or premium. So we were skewing premium because our cost structure using these wonderful yet more expensive cocoa beans was central to our recipe. So we were beginning to target places that had, you know, retailers that would want fine chocolate in the mix. What I had to learn was that the grocery store business in the United States is a rather mature industry, and they don't just give you shelf space. And in fact, what most people don't realize, and I didn't realize, and I had to learn uncomfortably, is that a lot of times you have to buy your shelf space or rent it. So if you go to a grocery store with free chocolate and say, would you put this on your shelf? They would say, no, you can't give it away for free. You literally have to come to them with a marketing proposal, spend dollars, rent the shelf space, and then you get your chocolate on the shelf. Once in a while, you'd find buyers who were generous that said, I'll give you a little shot at it for free or discounted. But the fact is, it is a very competitive market. The world probably doesn't need another chocolate bar. And there's a lot of people that are willing to pay for that shelf space. And unless you can play that game, you're going to have to find other ways to find market share. And that's what I had to do. But I started out doing what most people would, which is go to the familiar names in retailing. And you find out quickly how difficult that is to secure shelf space, no matter how good your chocolate is, no matter how cheap you make it for them.
Well, it's a funny story to read, but was truly frustrating for you. But reading the book, I started again. Another frustrating aspect of your journey was when you were going to open your booth up in New York at the Fancy Food Show? Is that what
it was? That's right.
And all you needed was for the guys in Ghana, just send me my chocolate bars and I'll set them up in the booth. Didn't quite work out that easily, did it?
No, it didn't. We ran into all sorts of problems at the very end, getting the recipe correct, and then getting things shipped. I mean, we really wanted to do this by sea freight because it's cheaper, frankly. Air freighting chocolate, which melts at body temperature. Now, mind you, Ghana is often with a heat index, 98 degrees or 104. So chocolate melts immediately. You take it outside of our factory and it begins to melt. So how do you get chocolate bars to an airport? Air freight them out and keep things from melting, or sea freight. So this logistics were so difficult. We had one snafu after the other trying to get the chocolate bars there on time. At the end, we did have to air freight a small number of them out at great expense and had something to sample on the opening day of the Fancy Food Show. But you'd be grateful for the very small things in life. And for me, it was, can we get 300 chocolate bars from Accra, Ghana to New York City, New York?
Well, Stephen, one has to read the book to appreciate it. Beautifully written with great humor, notwithstanding the many challenges that you have withstood. These challenges, structural, political, cultural, and Omanhini Cocoa Bean Company lives on to this day. Talk about your current state of the company today.
We continue to grow. We've hiring new people and very talented ones. And wonderful part is people far more talented than I. And when you start as an entrepreneur, you do most of everything yourself. And you quickly realize that you don't know what you're doing most of the time. There are other people that you either can't afford or you can't interest in your company that you'd really love to have be a part of it. So now we're at the part where we're actually getting people with experience at far bigger companies with far more sort of technical knowledge or marketing knowledge or branding knowledge than I brought to it that are really, I think, helping us move to the next level. So that's very satisfying that we're now all of a sudden on the radar screen. People say, this is an opportunistic place to build my career. So I'm thrilled by that. And we're doing very well. We've got more big plans to expand. We'd like to kind of continue to move up the cocoa value chain. And that will take us into probably some hospitality assets. Could be restaurants, could be some ecotourism as the next stage of Omanhini unfolds.
And so when you say ecotourism, you're talking about in
Ghana.
Ghana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to have a situation where we could bring people to the farms and really be able to educate and show and let them look at cocoa, see how it's harvested, help harvest if they want, and be able to have a sort of a very small line demo factory up there so we could have people actually see their cocoa beet transformed into a chocolate bar, maybe of a recipe of their own choosing if we do it right. So we've got all sorts of ideas for what to make Ghana really the focal point or the chief venue in the chocolate production trade.
And that leads me to ask you, is the factory that you started with the same one you're working with? Has it expanded? Are there other venues?
We've made changes and some new venues.
And my question is also, what's the landscape like today in Africa? Have other cocoa-producing countries like Côte d'Ivoire or others emulated your model, or is Ghana still the only value-added chocolate factory on the continent?
Others have tried, you know, and I don't know who has sustained it, but every once in a while, I mean, some years ago, there was an effort in Côte d'Ivoire to do this. And I think they had actually purchased some assets in the U.S. to do the production in the United States rather than doing it in Côte d'Ivoire. I haven't heard about it now in probably 4 years. So some of these things come and go. There's other small-scale people that are doing more confectionery, so they'll do things like truffles or bonbons. They're not necessarily going bean to bar at all. So there's different areas of the value chain where people are trying to experiment, and which is all wonderful. So, but you know, I think we were the first to really go bean to bar with a finished chocolate bar that was really export ready and export credible.
Do you find that your experience in your company has been a nice example for Ghanaians, because the country is going through this transition in 92, just as you were getting started? And you said at the top of the show, you know, Ghanaians would be kind of risk averse. Are they less risk averse now over a period of time, sort of noticeably?
I would say they're not. In some ways, I mean, you have one, like many African countries, a big part of the population is under 30. And these are phenomenal entrepreneurs. I've had a chance to speak with them and work with them. And they are the envy of the world. They will compete. They are competing successfully and will continue to compete successfully with entrepreneurs from all over the world. But it's a new generation. So this is, I started this, you know, almost 30 years ago. So they aspire to be entrepreneurs. I mean, it's almost in their DNA and they feel liberated to try. And I think they have less fear of failing, which is fundamentally one of the building blocks of being a good entrepreneur. You have to be comfortable with the fact that this first go-round may fail. It may not look good and it may not work, but they're thick-skinned and they don't mind losing face, which I think traditionally was a fear of some people. You look foolish. I felt I would look foolish if I failed, yet we all persevere. So this next generation is going to have none of those inhibitions.
The book has been out, and so what have the Ghanaians said about it?
I have shared it with a few Ghanaians who were in the book, and they loved it. They thought this is the peak behind the cocoa sector, which is so important culturally, economically, politically for our country. This is a peak behind the curtain. So this is the book we've sort of all been waiting for. But not too many other Ghanaians have read it. You can't get a hard copy in Ghana yet, to my knowledge. So you'd either have to download it, which you can do, or get an audiobook. So it's too early yet. I have not had widespread feedback from Ghana. Maybe we will soon. I suspect we will in the coming months, but it's too early yet, so I'm not quite sure.
Just briefly, Stephen, how much of a difference do you think it made in terms of foreign exchange, the establishment of a chocolate factory, in other words, a value added? Was that a measurable difference?
Well, it sure was at the beginning. People were very enthusiastic, both on the Ghanaian side and on the U.S. side. The Trade Promotion, Commerce Department, State Department folks, USAID, everyone said, oh, this is what we've been waiting for. But which should have been my first clue. If I was the first guy to bring it, to try it, smarter, better-funded people had obviously looked and probably said, no, it's not for us, the usual suspects. So the value-added part was a point of pride. It wasn't just to make a chocolate bar and move up the value chain and create the wealth that comes from adding value, but it was also to tell the story of Ghana in a high-value, demanding consumer market. Our biggest export markets are the United States and Japan. And I wanted to convince those ministers who weren't sure or were nervous about competing on the world stage that, you know something, we can compete. Forget about the money part. Forget about the value add. Let's see if we can compete, because we'll all feel good about ourselves if we can take a product and go head to head with some of the best manufacturers in the world. That's what I wanted to do, just as a point of pride, actually.
And you certainly did. The book is Obruni and the Chocolate Factory, An Unlikely Story of Globalization and Ghana's First Gourmet Chocolate Bar. The author is Stephen Wallace, founder and CEO of the Omanhini Cocoa Bean Company. Stephen, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your terrific story.
Oh, thank you so much, Carol and Philip. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you again.
And now our listeners can eat your heart out, because we'll be savoring some Ghanaian chocolate after this show. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and joining me on the program was VOA TV producer Philip Alexio. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.